Chapter 89. I waited as long as I could. Then I lowered myself slowly into the black hole. I fit easily and started to climb down the sturdy metal ladder. There were several steps, steep and precarious. I pointed the flashlight around. I could make out a dirt floor, corrugated tin walls. The ceiling bulbs had been broken. A narrow tunnel stretched out before me. I didn't hear any sounds up ahead, so I began to make my way down the tunnel. I moved slowly and carefully. I had the flashlight in one hand, my Glock in the other. I kept looking back for Kyle and Jamila. Where were they? I saw a discarded carcass a short way down the tunnel. I took a breath, focused my light on it. A single eye stared back. What I was looking at had been a small deer. Only the head and shoulders remained. I remember reading that tigers eat their prey starting at the rump. They consume bone and all. There were more smudged footprints in the dirt. It looked like two pairs, but I couldn't tell for sure in the dim light. There were smaller animal tracks that might have been the cat's. Oh, Jesus. I kept moving, trying to adjust my eyes to the semi-darkness. There were shards of glass all over the dirt. Someone had purposely smashed the overhead light bulbs. I heard the tiger roar and almost dropped the flashlight. It wasn't the smoothest move of my life, but I had never been in a closed-off area with a tiger before. The big cat's roar inside the tunnel echoed off the tin walls. It was unexpected and terrifying. I didn't know what to do next. The cat roared a second time, and I found that I couldn't move. I felt nailed to the spot. I wanted to turn around and go back, but that wasn't an option right now. I couldn't outrun a tiger in this tunnel, or anywhere else for that matter. Somewhere in the inky blackness of the tunnel up ahead, the cat was watching me. I debated shutting off the flashlight, but I kept it on for now. At least I would see the cat coming. I concentrated, stared out into the darkness, kept very still, as if that would help me. I had the Glock pointed straight ahead. I wondered if it was possible to bring down a big cat with a handgun. Even a powerful one. No way of knowing. No practice range for this kind of shooting. I had my doubts, though. I couldn't see the cat, but I could almost visualize the 30 teeth in his mouth. I remembered the wounds a cat had made on the victims in Golden Gate Park. Someone called out. Someone was there, behind me. Alex, where are you? Alex! I heard Jamila coming forward in the tunnel, and I let out a breath. Don't move, I whispered. Don't do anything. The tiger's in here. I didn't dare move. I wasn't even sure I could. It was a standoff. I couldn't imagine the tiger being as frightened as I was. Was the sire there? The two brothers? Anybody else? Alex? It was Kyle. He was whispering. But if I heard him, stay right there, Kyle. I mean it. Listen to me. Stay where you are unless you want me dead. Everything happened in a terrifying instant. Suddenly the cat rushed at me. Full speed, half speed, very goddamn fast. Shadows, a blur of fur. It seemed to leap straight up into the cone of light shining from my flashlight. The cat was tensed muscle, raw speed, gleaming teeth, and the widest, brightest eyes. Tremendous focus. It was aimed at me as surely as a deadly bullet. Its upper body twisted athletically, showing off incredible strength. It seemed to be 3 to 4 feet off the ground, coming straight at me, unstoppable. I had no choice, no options, and no room for error. I didn't even have to think about my next move. It just happened. I squeezed the trigger of my Glock. I fired off 3 quick shots. All head and upper body shots, I hoped, but I was just guessing. The cat kept coming at me. It didn't even slow down. The gunshots couldn't stop it, could they? I had no defense and no place to run, no place to hide. The big cat hit me hard, knocked me down like weak prey. I waited for the powerful jaws to clamp down on me, to crush my bones. I might have screamed. I don't know what the hell I did. I'd never been more afraid, not even close. The cat kept going past me. It made no sense. I didn't understand. A few feet up the tunnel, I heard a loud thud. It was down. I had shot and killed a tiger. Chapter 90.
Holy shit! Holy shit!
The words exploded out of Jamila's mouth. Then she smiled.
Jesus, I don't believe it.
She stared down at the huge, fierce animal that had tried to kill me and was now lying at her feet. I pushed myself up, forced my legs to move. I took tenuous steps back to where she and Kyle were standing. The cat lay twisted across the width of the tunnel. It didn't move, and it wasn't going to.
Are they down here in the tunnel? The Lost Boys? Kyle asked in a whisper. The Sire?
I haven't seen anybody, just footprints and the cat. Let's go, I finally said. The tunnel was much longer than I would have thought. I wasn't even sure which direction we were headed. Toward the road? The foothills? The Pacific Ocean? I sent men toward the perimeters of the property, about 500 or 600 yards out. It spreads us thin, Kyle said. I don't like it. I didn't answer him. I was still shaky, not quite over my bad moment of truth with the tiger. My heart was pumping like an engine pushed to its limit. I wondered if I might be going into shock.
Alex? Jamila spoke. You with us? You okay?
Just give me a minute. I'll be fine. Let's keep going. Soon we could see the faintest glimmer of daylight up ahead. That was hopeful. But where were we coming out of the tunnel? I can't see how far it is, I said, or what's between us and the light. My hip brushed against something, then my shoulder. I jumped back and my whole body shuddered. But it was only a valve sticking out from the tunnel wall. Nothing. Scared the hell out of me, though. Then I could see part of the scene outside. A couple of cypresses leaning away from the wind. A streak of soft gray sky. It wasn't far, maybe 30 or 40 yards. Usually the most dangerous part of a raid was breaking in, but now it was getting out of this dark tunnel. I turned to Jamila and Kyle and whispered, "I'll go first." I knew I was better with a gun than Kyle, and I was physically stronger than Jamila, at least I thought so. Besides, this was the way it had been the past few years. Gary Sonigi, Casanova, Jeffrey Schaefer, now the Alexander brothers and their sire. I always go in first. How long am I going to keep it up? Why am I doing this?
Don't forget, they're human, Jamila said. They bleed too.
I wanted to believe she was right. I moved forward quietly, quickly. I hesitated at the mouth of the tunnel. Took a breath. One Mississippi. Two. Then out into the big bad world. I don't know why, but I yelled at the top of my voice as I burst outside into the light. No words, just a loud scream. Actually, maybe I do know why. I was afraid of these two killers. Of their merciless cult. Of the Sire. Maybe they bled, but they weren't human. Not like the rest of us. I was in a pocket chasm surrounded by low-lying hills. I saw no one out there. No sign that anyone had been there recently. They had to have come this way, though. The tiger must have been in the tunnel with somebody. Jamila and Kyle came out of the tunnel behind me. The looks on their faces showed their disappointment, their fatigue and confusion. I heard it before I saw anything. Then a black pickup truck came roaring around the side of one of the hills. It was headed straight for me. And I had a choice. Dive back into the tunnel, or hold my ground in the face of the blonde killers. They were inside the truck. I could see both of them. I held my ground.
Chapter 91.
The faces of the killers glared through the curved windshield of the truck. I raised my gun, held it as steady as I could. Jamila and Kyle did the same. The black Ford truck kept coming fast, almost as if they were daring us to shoot. So we fired. The windshield splintered. Bullets pinged off the roof and hood. The roar of the guns was deafening in my ears. The acrid smell of cordite filled my nostrils. Suddenly the truck stopped, then shot into reverse. I kept shooting, trying to hit the driver as the target distanced itself. The vehicle backing away, veering left, then right, then left. I took off running up the hill, my legs heavy, as if my shoes held lead weights. I couldn't let them get away. We'd come too far, gotten too close. These two would kill again and again. They were madmen, monsters, and so was whoever had sent them on their mission.
Jamila and Kyle were climbing up the steep grassy terrain a few steps behind me. The three of us seemed to be moving in slow motion. The pickup truck was weaving wildly, its rear end fishtailing. I was hoping, praying that it would flip as it climbed in reverse up the steep side of the hill. I heard the grinding of gears, and suddenly the truck flew forward. It was coming at us again, picking up speed. I went down on one knee, aimed carefully, and put three shots into the windshield. The glass was filled with bullet holes.
"Alex, get out of the way!" Jamila shouted. "Alex, move it! Now! Alex!"
The pickup kept coming. I didn't move away. I put a shot right where I figured the driver had to be. Then another. The big black truck was almost on top of me. I thought that I could feel heat from the engine. My face and neck were in a hot sweat. I had the irrational thought that a vampire can only be killed by a stake, fire, or by destroying its domain where it sleeps during the day. I didn't believe in vampires. I believed in evil, though. I had seen it enough times to believe. The two brothers were twisted murderers. That's all they were. I jumped sideways just before the pickup would have run me down. I rushed down the hillside behind the truck. I was hoping it would flip. And then it did. I felt like shouting. The truck bounced heavily on its side, then on its roof, then continued to roll over several times. Finally, it stopped, resting on the driver's side, teetering slightly. Black smoke coiled up from the engine. No one got out at first. Then, the younger brother climbed out. His face was streaked with blood and soot. He didn't speak, just glared at us. And then he roared like an animal. It seemed as if he had gone insane. "Don't make us shoot you," I shouted at him. He didn't seem to hear. He was in a blind rage. Michael Alexander wore long, sharp, canine fangs, and they were bloody. His own blood? His eyes were red.
"You shot William! You killed my brother!" he shrieked at us. "You murdered him! He was better than all of you!"
Then he charged. And I couldn't bring myself to shoot. Michael Alexander was insane. He wasn't responsible anymore. He kept growling, frothing from the mouth. His eyes were wild, rolling in their sockets. Every muscle on his body was tightly flexed. I couldn't kill this tortured man-child. I braced myself to tackle him. I hoped I could bring him down. Then Kyle fired, once. The shot struck him where his nose had been just an instant before. A dark, bloody hole appeared at the center of his face. There was no surprise or shock, just sudden obliteration. Then he crumpled to the ground. There was no doubt he was dead. I had been wrong about Kyle. He could shoot. He was an expert, full of surprises. I needed to think about that, but not right now. Suddenly I heard another voice. It was coming from inside the pickup. Someone was trapped. William? Was the brother alive? I approached the overturned vehicle slowly, gun in hand. The engine was still smoking. I was afraid the truck might blow. I climbed onto the teetering wreck and managed to pull open the bent door. I saw William, shot to death, his face a sorry, bloody mask. Then I found myself staring into the angriest, most arrogant eyes. I recognized them immediately. It was almost impossible to shock me anymore, but this was another jolt. "So you're the one," I said.
"You killed them, and you will be killed," a voice threatened. "You'll die. You will die, Cross."
I was looking at Peter Weston, the vampire expert I'd met weeks before in Santa Barbara. He was cut up, injured, and bleeding, but he was in total control. Even with my gun aimed at his face, he was cool and superior, so confident. I remembered sitting across from him at the Davidson Library in Santa Barbara. He had told me he was a real vampire. I guess I believed him now. I finally found the right words. "You're the sire."
Chapter 92.
I tried a couple of sessions with the creepy and surreal Peter Weston that night in the jail at Santa Cruz. Kyle was attempting to get him transferred to the East Coast, but I doubted he would be successful.
California wanted him. Weston wore a long-sleeved black velvet shirt and black leather pants. He was as pale as paper. Thin blue veins were visible under the translucent skin of his temples. His lips were full, and the pigment appeared redder than most people's. The sire almost didn't seem human, and I was pretty sure that was the effect he wanted to convey. It was emotionally disturbing and draining to be in the same room with him. Jamila and I had talked about it briefly, and we both felt the same thing. Weston had none of the usual qualities that we associate with humans. Conscience, sociability, deep emotion, sympathy, empathy. His entire persona was that of the sire. He was a killer, a ghoul, a real-life bloodsucker. "I'm not going to try and scare you with interrogation room threats," I said in a low-key way. Weston appeared not to be listening, bored. Indifferent? Smart as hell? Actually, as the sire, he was an extraordinary person to encounter. Haughty, superior, intense, physically striking. He had the most piercing eyes. He put on an act for me in Santa Barbara, the harmless scholar with books about vampires to recommend. He cocked his head and stared intently into my eyes. Weston was looking for something. I couldn't tell what. I held his gaze, and that seemed to irritate him. "Fuck off," he snapped. "What is it?" I finally asked. "What's on your mind, Peter? Is it that I'm not worthy to question you now?" He smiled, and there was even a hint of warmth in it. He could be charming, I knew. I'd found that out in the library in Santa Barbara.
"If I talk to you, if I told you everything that I feel and believe, you wouldn't understand," he said. "You would be even more lost and confused than you are now."
"Try me," I said. He smiled again, but said nothing. "I know that you miss William and Michael. You don't show it, but you love them," I said. "I know that much about you. I know you feel things deeply." Then Peter Weston nodded, almost imperceptibly. The gesture was regal. He did miss William and Michael. I was right about that. He was sad that they were dead. He finally spoke again.
"Yes, Detective Cross. I feel more deeply than you can begin to imagine. You have no idea. You have no clue how someone like me thinks."
Then he was quiet again. The sire had nothing more to say. We mere mortals just wouldn't understand. I left him like that. It was over.
Chapter 93.
I was feeling partially relieved. Better, anyway. The murder case seemed to be solved, at least. Peter Weston was in jail. We'd done everything we could about his cult. The pressure had been eliminated. We'd stopped the bleeding. Jamila had left the previous night. We promised to keep in touch, and I knew we would. I was headed up to the airport that morning to catch a flight from San Francisco to D.C. I was going home, and that felt good. The details were still coming in, but I feared we would never know everything about the strange, murderous cult that had sprung up in California. It was usually that way in homicide. You never knew as much as you wanted to know. That's the single most basic truth about being a detective, and you never see it on TV or in the movies. I guess the endings wouldn't be as satisfying if they were closer to reality. Peter Weston had met Daniel and Charles when they had played in Los Angeles. Weston already had his own followers in Santa Cruz and Santa Barbara, but he feigned allegiance until he felt he was strong enough to be the sire. Then he dispatched William and Michael Alexander to do his dirty work. Supposedly, there were followers in nearly 100 cities, especially now that the internet had brought us all so close together. Something was still bothering me. I couldn't figure out exactly what it was, but it troubled me all the way to San Francisco. It was eating me from the inside out. Fear and dread. But about what? There was a 45-minute layover, and I got off the plane.
A jumble of bad thoughts played through my brain. I felt wired, itchy. The original San Francisco vampire murders were still on my mind. And the fucking mastermind. Jamila was here in San Francisco, but that was a whole other subject. What was bothering me? Then I thought I knew what it was. Maybe I'd known all along. I called Jam at her office in the Hall of Justice. I was informed that she had the day off. I called her apartment, but there was no answer. Maybe she was out on one of the 5-mile runs she bragged about. Or she had a date with Tim Bradley from the Examiner, as if that was any of my business. But maybe not. Where was she? Had something happened to her? Or was I just being paranoid beyond belief? I was definitely working too hard. I didn't need this. I really didn't need this. I couldn't take the chance. I hurried to the American Airlines counter and canceled my flight out of San Francisco. I called Nana and told her I had to stay in California for a few hours. I would be in later tonight. Someone out here might be in trouble, I said.
Yes, and that someone is you, Nana said. Goodbye, Alex.
She hung up on me again. She was right to want me home, but I was right in not wanting anybody else to be hurt. I rented a car from Budget, beginning to feel that I was completely losing it. Charles Manson's words came to mind. Total paranoia is just total awareness. I had always thought that Manson was wrong about everything, but maybe he wasn't. Maybe he was dead on right about paranoia. I had a powerful gut feeling that Jamila Hughes could be in danger right now. I couldn't shake it off. Couldn't ignore it. Even if I wanted to. The vibrations in my head were too strong, overwhelming. It was one of my famous feelings, and I had to go with it. I thought about my former partner, Patsy Hampton, and her murder. I remembered Betsy Cavalier, and her murder. And Detective Maureen Cook in New Orleans. A long time ago, as a homicide detective, I had just about stopped believing in coincidences. Still, I had no logical reason to believe that a psychopathic killer could be out here in California, possibly stalking Inspector Jamila Hughes. I just felt it. Total awareness. The mastermind was out here, wasn't he? It was the sense I had. I waited for his call. I was ready to nail him once and for all. I was so ready.
Chapter 94.
I drove from the airport to Jamila's apartment at several miles above the posted speed limit. On the way, I used my cell phone. There was still no answer at her place. I was already in a cold sweat. I had never followed a hunch quite like this one. I thought about what I could do right now. One possibility was to call in help from the SFPD, but I didn't like it. Police officers are logical creatures and coldly suspicious of gut feelings. My track record with psychopaths might buy me some credibility in Washington, but not out here in California. I could call the FBI, but I chose not to do it. There were a couple of reasons why. More gut feelings that I wanted to keep to myself for a while longer. I decided to park a block over from Texas Street, where Jamila lived, but I took a ride up the steep Potrero Hill first. I turned onto the street about a half a dozen blocks south of her place. Then I toured the connecting streets. There was a mixed style of row houses, the more charming wooden ones from the early 1900s, and the boxier 3- and 4-story ones with lots of aluminum detail. I could see the bay, the loading docks of Pier 84, and Oakland in the distance. I passed the new Potrero Market, J.J. Maxx, the North Star Restaurant, Jamila's home turf. But where was Jamila? The traffic was fairly heavy. I hoped my rented sedan wouldn't be spotted easily, and that I'd see Jamila lugging groceries or jogging home from a nearby park where she'd worked out. But I didn't see her. Damn it, where was she? Not that she didn't have a right to a day off. I couldn't imagine anything happening to her, but that was the way I felt about Patsy Hampton. And then about Betsy Cavalier. 2 dead partners in 2 years. I didn't believe in coincidences. Patsy Hampton had been murdered by a British diplomat named Schaefer. I was almost certain of that.
Betsy's murder remained unsolved, and that was the one that worried me. I kept thinking about the mastermind. Somehow I had become a part of his story, his fantasy world. How? Why? I had received a late phone call from him one night in the summer.
Betsy Cavalier is dead. I'm the one you called Mastermind. That's a name I can live with. I am that good.
The killer had used a knife on her. Everywhere. Even between Betsy's legs. He hated women. That was clear. I had encountered only one other killer who hated women so much. Casanova in North Carolina. But I was sure Casanova was dead and couldn't have killed Betsy Cavalier.
Still,
I felt some kind of strange link to Casanova and what had happened in North Carolina. What was the connection? I found a spot and parked about 2 blocks from Jamila Hughes's apartment on the hill near 18th. Her building was older, a remodeled yellow Victorian with the familiar three-sided bay windows you often see in San Francisco. Very nice, very homey. There were neat little signs on the trees. Friends of the Urban Forest. I called her again on the cell. Still no answer. My heart was pumping fast. The cold sweat continued. I had to do something. I went to the front door of the house, rang the bell, but no one answered.
Damn it! Where is she?
Safe neighborhood signs were stuck in bright green patches of grass up and down the street. I hoped the street was very safe. I prayed to God that it was as safe as it looked. I went back and waited in the car, fidgeted, grew even more nervous and impatient. I thought about who the mastermind might be. Then about Betsy's murder again. I thought about Casanova, the gentleman caller. About Kate McTiernan, who'd been abducted in North Carolina. Why was that on my mind now? What was the connection? I couldn't get the lurid and devastating murder scenes out of my head. Not Jamila. Don't let this happen again. Don't let her get hurt. As I sat there worrying, my phone rang. I answered immediately. It was him. He was playing his cruel games. He seemed so close.
Where are you, Dr. Cross? I thought you were heading home to kith and kin. Maybe it's time that you did. Your work is done out here. There's nothing more you can do. Nothing at all. We wouldn't want anything to happen to Nana Mama and the kids, would we? That would be the worst thing, wouldn't it? The absolute worst.
Chapter 95.
I immediately called Nana in Washington. Either she wasn't there or she was still mad at me and wasn't picking up the phone.
Damn it! Answer the phone, Nana!
I frantically called home again, but there was still no answer.
Pick up! Pick up, damn it! Pick up the phone!
Sweat had begun to coat my neck and forehead. This was my darkest nightmare. My worst fear come true. What could I do from out here? I called Samson and told him to rush over to my house, then get back to me immediately. He didn't question me for a second. I'm sending a squad car now. It'll be there in minutes. I'll be right behind it. I'll get back to you, Alex, he said. I sat in the car and anxiously waited for Samson's call. My head was spinning with all kinds of terrible thoughts and images. There was nothing I could do. Not for Jamila if she was in trouble. Not for my own family back in Washington. I thought about the mastermind and the way he'd operated in the past. There were always dramatic taunts and barbs. And then, when I least expected it, he would act. He would make a strike to the heart. When I least expected it. Action, not words. Horrible murders. He knew I hadn't returned to Washington. Did he know for sure that I was in San Francisco? I couldn't focus as much as I needed to. Was it possible that he was right here on Jamila Street? Was the killer watching me now? He had shown that he was smart enough to follow me and not be seen. Did he want a showdown? The cell phone rang again. My heart jumped in my chest.
I fumbled with the buttons.
Cross, I said. Everybody's okay, Alex. I'm at the house with Nana and the kids. They're safe and sound. They're with me now.
I shut my eyes and sighed in relief.
Put her on, I told Samson. Don't take no for an answer from her. I need to talk to Nana about what we're going to do next.
Chapter 96.
Samson promised to stay with Nana and the kids until I could get home. There was no one that I trusted more. No one in the world they would be safer with. Still, I couldn't be sure. And that was a terrible weight to carry. I didn't feel I could leave California until I had at least located Jamila and knew she was safe. Finally, I called Tim Bradley at the Examiner. He didn't know where she was, or even that she had taken a day off from work. Maybe she needed to get away from town, to get away from being a homicide detective. I was beginning to feel that maybe I made a mistake by stopping in San Francisco. The longer I sat on the street outside her house, the more convinced I was of it. Maybe the job was finally getting to me. The instincts go first. Every time I considered leaving, I remembered the night I arrived at Betsy Cavalieri's house, saw her dead body. And besides, instincts had gotten me here in my career. Feelings, gut reactions, experiences from the past. Maybe just plain stubbornness. I stayed on surveillance, stayed at my post. I got out of the car a couple of times, walked a little up and down the block, climbed back in the car, waited some more. I felt more than a little ridiculous, but I wouldn't give in to it. I checked in with Samson again. Everything was okay at home. Another homicide detective I know, Jerome Thurman, had arrived at the house too. Double duty against the mastermind. Was that enough protection? Then I saw Jamila coming up the street in her Saab. I actually clapped my hands together. I smacked the dashboard with my palm. Yes! Thank God she was safe. There she was. She parked about a half block from her house on Texas Street and got out, pulling a University of San Francisco gym bag behind her. I wanted to run up and hug her, but I stayed in my car. Her hair was up in a ponytail. She was wearing a dark blue tee and loose gray workout pants. She was all right. She hadn't been hurt. Jamila hadn't been murdered by the mastermind. I stared through the windshield, waiting to see if anyone was watching her, stalking her. Part of me wanted to leave well enough alone now, to go home to Washington. But I kept remembering what had happened to Betsy Cavalier after we finished our case together. Why then? Why my partner? I almost didn't want to go there. I gave Jamila time to get inside. Then I called her on my cell.
This is Jamila Hughes. Your message is important to me. Please leave it at the beep.
Damn it. I hated those machines. We still didn't have one back home. Jamila, this is Alex Cross. Call me. It's important. Please.
Hi, Alex. Where are you? How are you?
I could hear the smile in her voice, and it sounded inappropriate because of the emotional state I was in. Please be careful. I continued with what I was going to leave her as a message. I told her why I was concerned. Finally, I had to admit the worst. That I was on the street outside her apartment.
Well, come inside, for God's sake, she said.
There were no recriminations, not even any surprise in her voice.
I think you're overreacting, maybe. Let's talk about it, though. Let's talk this thing through.
No, let me stay out here for a while. I hope you don't think I'm being too crazy. Whoever killed Betsy has contacted me ever since her death. The mastermind could be here in San Francisco. He killed her right after we finished our case. Detective Cook was murdered after the magicians were killed in New Orleans. That gave her pause.
Maybe I think you're a little crazy, Alex, but I understand why you would be. I see where you're going with this. I'm also touched that you came here to watch over me. And what happened to your last partner does scare me.
It helped that I knew where Jam was and that I had actually talked to her. After we spoke, I sat in my car and watched her street. I had learned to follow my instincts over the years, even when my own logic system rejected them. even when everybody else did too.
I don't know how many times I had thought about Betsy Cavalier's murder and wondered who the killer was.
But I did it again as I sat in the car. I stayed there for several hours. Jamila and I talked a couple of times. She urged me to come up to her apartment. I said, no. Let me do it my way, Jam. It was getting late, though, and I was beginning to fade. I saw the lights in her apartment go off. Good for her. At least one of us was acting sane. I continued to wait. Something powerful, dramatic, haunting was nagging at me. Something I almost didn't want to face. The clues had been there, but I hadn't wanted to see them for what they were. I wanted to follow my famous instincts. Look where it had gotten me. I had blown it for so long. Then I saw him. And everything made sense. Suddenly the puzzle was clear. All the pieces fit. Not just Betsy's murder, but the Casanova murder. The stalking of Kate McTiernan. The fact that he'd always been able to keep a step ahead of me. The killer was here on Jamila Street. The mastermind was here in San Francisco. I was sure, and it made me dizzy with fear. But it also filled me with incredible disappointment. Sadness, confusion. I felt like I might throw up. It was Kyle Craig. He was watching Jamila's place, stalking her like the madman that he was. The goddamn mastermind had come here to kill her. Now, how could I stop him?
Chapter 97.
Jamila, are you awake? I said in a low, tense voice. I felt a shudder run through me. It couldn't get any worse than this. I still had my eye on Kyle. He was definitely watching Jamila's building. God damn him to hell.
I am now. No, I was awake. Where are you, Alex? Don't tell me you're still outside. Please don't tell me that. Alex, what the hell is going on?
Listen to me. The mastermind is outside your place. I can see him. I think he'll try to get inside soon. I want to come up there, and I don't want him to see me. Is there a back way? Then I told her who the killer was. She exploded with anger. Most of it directed at Kyle.
I knew there was something seriously wrong with him, but not this wrong. We have to stop that son of a bitch. I don't care how smart he's supposed to be.
She told me where to look for a service entrance, and then a fire escape that would take me to her floor. I hurried around in the shadows. I didn't think that Kyle had seen me. I hope not. But after all, he was the mastermind. He was smart, as clever as anyone I'd ever worked against. He knew about surveillance, probably a lot more than I did. He didn't make mistakes, at least not until now. I found the back entrance of her building easily, and I hurried up the stairs. I tried not to make noise. I had no way of knowing where Kyle was right now. When I got to her apartment, the door was open. My stomach dropped, and I felt sick.
Jamila?
She immediately peeked out through the doorway.
Come inside. I'm fine, Alex. We've got him now, not the other way around.
I hurried inside the apartment, and we kept all the lights off. I could still see most of the living room and kitchen, the doorway to a small terrace, a bay window with bench seating. Her home. The place where he wanted to violate her. I snuck a look outside. I didn't see Kyle on the street. He was on the move. Jamila didn't look frightened, just perplexed and angry. She had her service revolver out. She was ready for whatever might happen. I don't think I had fully taken in what had just happened outside. Everything felt unreal. My vision was tunneled. My nerves felt shredded and raw. Kyle Craig had been my friend. We had worked half a dozen cases together.
Why is he outside, Alex?
Jamila finally asked.
Why is he coming after me? I don't understand that asshole. What did I do to him?
I stared into her eyes, hesitated a second or two, then finally spoke. He's not really here to get you. At least I don't think so. It's about me. It's about Kyle and me.
I've become part of his fantasy, the story he tells himself every day. He's proving how much better than me he is. He has to prove that he really is the mastermind.
Chapter 98. The mastermind had already made his next move, though he knew it was only a half step in the greater scheme of things. He had pulled back. He was 6 blocks away from Jamila Hughes' apartment, standing on a hill past the Jackson playground. It allowed him to watch her building, the bay window, the small terrace on one side. He enjoyed this, the intractable imposition of his will, his ego, on the world. It had been this way for more than a dozen years. No one had come close to capturing him, or even suspecting who he really was. Cross was inside now, and that made everything either very hard, or perhaps easier. There was another decision to be made soon. Should he risk everything at this point? Change everything? For years, he had been living a complicated double life. He'd done whatever he wanted, wherever, whenever. He had enjoyed his freedom, and how many others had even tasted that forbidden fruit? He had been the cop and the criminal. But maybe it was time for a change. Maybe his life had become too safe, too predictable. Kyle loved the hunt, and in that way, he was like Casanova and the Gentleman Caller, two very talented killers he had known well, one working in North Carolina, the other in Southern California. He found that he agreed with Casanova that men needed to be hunters by nature, and so he hunted, men and women. And he enjoyed killing both sexes, but he went an important step further. He hunted their killers as well. He eliminated his competition. He beat them at their own games. He had known Casanova years before the meticulous and very nasty killer was caught by himself and Dr. Cross. He had played murder games with Casanova and with the Gentleman Caller. Kiss the girls and make them cry. Kyle had even fallen in love with one of the victims, young Kate McTiernan. He still had a soft spot for dear, sweet Kate. He had been so many things to so many people, played so many roles, and he had only just begun. He had been the mastermind, but he also helped capture the man believed to be the mastermind. How could you beat that for puzzle-making and puzzle-solving? He'd been an elusive killer in Baltimore, in Cincinnati, in Roanoke, Virginia, in Philadelphia, until he had tired of those cities and the minor roles he played in them. He was husband to Louise, father to Bradley in Virginia. He was on the fast track inside the FBI with one significant problem. He believed they were finally on to him. He was sure of it, though God, they were such obvious plotting fools. So many exciting roles, so many poses, that sometimes Kyle Craig wondered who he actually was. Now the game with Alex Cross had to end. He'd felt the need to taunt and torture Cross, to prove he was the homicide detective's master. And then he had gone over the edge a little himself. It had happened when he killed Betsy Cavalier, one of his own agents. Actually, the killing couldn't be helped. Cavalier had become suspicious of him while she was chasing the mastermind with Cross. She had to go, had to die. And so did Cross. Cross was loyal to his friends, trusting, and it had become his greatest flaw, his singular weakness. But Cross would have caught on to him, even if he hadn't yet. And of course, Cross's instincts had brought him here to watch over Inspector Hughes. Cross needed to be a good man, an ethical cop, a protector. What a waste of intellect. What a pity that Cross couldn't have been an even better adversary. Cross had seen him on the street, so what came next? Whatever it was, it certainly had his adrenaline flowing. This was so good. Kyle knew he had a little time to figure it out. What to do? They were inside Hughes's apartment. He had the edge on them. He wouldn't lose his edge, his advantage. he made his next move.
Chapter 99.
You know, I never liked him, Alex,
Jamila said as we waited in the semi-darkness of her apartment.
He seemed so cold, almost mechanical to me. And I'm telling you, he doesn't like women. I felt it instantly.
Well, unfortunately, I did like Kyle. He's clever as hell. He even rigged calls from the mastermind when he and I were together. Now I need to figure out who he really was. There's no psychosis involved, at least I don't think so. He's organized. He can obviously work out elaborate plans. For once, I wish he would call.
Be careful what you wish for, Jamila said.
She and I were sitting beside a shelving unit on the hardwood floor in her living room. There was also a workout bench. Nothing too fancy, an older model. 5 and 10 pound free weights were scattered on the floor. So were magazines and sections of the Chronicle. I hoped that Kyle couldn't see into the apartment, that he didn't have binoculars, or possibly a night scope attached to a rifle. I knew he could shoot from the way he'd taken down Michael Alexander. He was good at a lot of things. Just in case, Jamila and I tried to keep away from the windows.
It makes me dizzy to think about what he's done so far. I wonder if we'll ever know the extent of it, she said.
If we catch him, he'll want to talk. Kyle will want to show off what he's done. If he comes after us tonight, maybe we'll find everything out.
You think he knows you're here?
I sighed, shrugged. He probably knows I'm here. Maybe tonight is his coming out party. I know one thing. He won't do what we expect. The mastermind never does. That's the only real pattern he has. We talked about calling in reinforcements, but Jamila thought it would probably scare Kyle off. He wanted the two of us, right? That's what he would get. Do you want to taunt me anymore, you bastard?
Go for it. Bring it, Kyle.
So the two of us sat there in the dark, and it was almost cozy. Jamila finally reached out and touched my hand. Then we moved together, leaned against each other. We waited.
At least it's comfortable, Jamila whispered. As stakeouts go.
No place like home, right? It was a little before 4 when we heard noises outside. Jamila turned and looked at me. We raised our guns. For the first time, I confronted the idea of shooting Kyle, a man I had thought was my friend. I didn't like the feeling. I wasn't sure how I would react, and that scared me. There were soft footsteps outside on the terrace. In a way, I was relieved. This was the showdown Kyle wanted. He was coming. I figured that the story he'd been telling for so long, his fantasy life, had finally taken over. Maybe he was psychotic now. That would give us an advantage.
Real careful, I whispered, and touched the back of Jamila's hand. Try to look at it the way he does. Kyle thinks he has us where he wants us. He picked the lock quickly and expertly, a minimum of effort. I realized that he had been watching her place. He knew enough to come up the back stairs, and then he'd climbed a metal ladder onto the terrace. The lock on the door to the terrace of the apartment made a soft click. Then nothing happened. We're good. Everything's cool, Jamila whispered. This time we win. We waited in the dark near the door. It finally opened. Oh, so slowly. Kyle came inside. He moved toward us, in a low crouch. Obviously, he couldn't see where we were, but we could see him.
I hit Kyle with all my weight, full force, every ounce of strength that I had. I slammed him hard against the living room wall. The whole apartment shook. Books and glasses fell to the floor from open shelves. I was surprised that we didn't go right through the wall. I clipped his chin with an elbow, as hard as I could. Felt good. Kyle was wiry and strong, but I was pumped to take him. I hit him with a hard, short right hand. It snapped into his jaw. I hit him in the solar plexus. A real gut-wrencher. I was going to hit him again, but then Jamila flicked on the room lights. My brain caught fire. My body shuddered. It wasn't Kyle Craig.
Chapter 100.
Get down! Get down! Get below the windows! I yelled at Jamila. I was afraid she might be hit by rifle fire. Kyle could be out there, and I knew that he could shoot. She went down and lay facing me, and also the man I had tackled coming in the door. He looked as confused as I felt. Who the hell was he?
What had just happened? Who was this guy, and where was Kyle? Jamila had her service revolver pointed at his chest. Her hand was amazingly steady. His nose was bleeding badly from where it hit him. He was well-built, probably early 30s, short hair, a light-skinned black man. Everything was complete chaos in my brain.
Who the hell are you? Who are you?
I yelled at the dazed, bleeding man on the floor.
FBI, he panted. I'm a federal agent. Put down the gun. Put it down now.
Jamila was yelling, too.
I'm San Francisco PD, and I'm definitely not putting down my gun, mister. And what are you doing in my apartment? She shouted.
I could almost see her mind working, and she wasn't thinking nice thoughts.
Talk to us!
He shook his head.
I don't have to answer your questions. Wallet's in the rear left pocket. Badge and ID. I'm FBI, goddammit.
Stay down, I yelled. There could be someone outside with a gun. Did Kyle Craig send you here? I asked. The look on the agent's face answered the question for me, but he refused to confirm or deny.
I told you. I don't have to answer questions. You sure as hell do.
Jamila got in the last word. I did the only thing I could under the circumstances. I called the FBI. Four agents from the San Francisco office got to the apartment at a little past 5 in the morning. We were wary of the windows, though I doubted that Kyle was still nearby, or even in San Francisco. The mastermind was a step ahead. I should have known, and in a way I had known, that he wouldn't do the expected. During the next couple of hours, exasperated agents from the bureau tried to reach Kyle Craig. They couldn't, and it shook them up. They began to give some credence to my story that Kyle might be the man behind murders going back for several years. Kyle had sent the agent to Jamila's apartment and ordered him to break in. He'd told the agent that someone had murdered an SFPD inspector and Alex Cross inside. Then things started to get really hot. I was the one who heated them up. Chapter 101. At 7:30 in the morning, I was on the receiving end of a phone call from FBI Director Ronald Burns in Washington. Burns was cautious and wary, so I knew he wouldn't call me himself unless he had evidence that there were serious problems with Kyle. I was still confused and hurt, but I recognized the emotions as appropriate and sane. Kyle Craig was the madman, not me. Tell me whatever you know, Director, I said. I know a lot about Kyle, but you know things that I don't. Tell me what they are. It's important that I know everything. Burns didn't answer right away. There was a long pause on his end of the line. I knew him well enough to know that he was a friend of Kyle's. At least he thought he had been. We'd all been wrong, for so long. We'd been fooled and betrayed by someone we had trusted. Finally, Burns began to speak. This probably goes back to the days of the Kiss the Girls case. Maybe before it. You know that Kyle was an undergrad at Duke University? He knew Will Rudolph, the gentleman caller, from his student days at Duke. During the case, Kyle may have been responsible for the death of a reporter named Beth Lieberman from the LA Times. She was closing in on Will Rudolph. I shut my eyes and shook my head. I had helped solve the Kiss case. I knew that Kyle had attended Duke, but not about his relationship with the gentleman caller, a killer who had terrorized LA. I had briefly suspected Kyle in the case, but his alibis held up perfectly. Of course they had. Why didn't you talk to me? I asked Burns. I was trying to understand the FBI's position. So far, I couldn't. We didn't begin to really suspect Kyle until the murder of Betsy Cavalier. We had no proof even then. We weren't sure if he was a possible killer or the best agent in the bureau.
Jesus, Ron. We could have talked. We should have talked.
Well, he's on the run now.
You should have told me. I hope you're telling me everything now.
Alex, you know what we know. Maybe more. I hope you're telling us everything. After I finished with Burns, I called Sampson in Washington. I told him the latest, and it blew John's mind. He had moved Nana and the kids out of our house on Fifth Street. Only he and I knew where they were now. Everything okay there? I asked. Everybody settled in all right?
Are you fucking kidding, Alex? Nana's pissed off like I've never seen her before.
If Kyle Craig came after her, I'd put my money on Nana. Yeah, the kids are cool, though. They don't know what's happening, but they've guessed it isn't good. I cautioned him again.
Don't leave them for a minute.
Not a second, John. I'm coming back to Washington on the next flight. I don't know how Kyle could trace you there, but don't underestimate him. He's loose. He's very dangerous. For some reason, he wants to hurt me and maybe my family. If I can figure out why that is, maybe I can stop him.
And if not? Samson asked.
I let the question hang.
Chapter 102.
I had to say goodbye to Jamila Hughes again, and each time it was a little harder. We'd been through so much together in such a short time. I made her promise to be extremely careful, even paranoid, for the next few days. She promised. Then finally I got on a plane out of San Francisco International. The mysterious phone calls had finally stopped, but that was scary and unsettling too. I didn't know where Kyle was or what he was doing. Was he still watching me? Had he somehow followed me back to Washington? I shouldn't have been entertaining thoughts like that, but I was, and I couldn't stop them from coming. Did he have binoculars focused on me as I walked up the sidewalk to my Aunt Tia's house in Chapel Gate, Maryland, about 15 miles from Baltimore? How could Kyle know I was here? Why? Because that's what he did for a living. Could he get past Samson and me? I didn't think so. But how could I know with complete certainty? The kids were enjoying their short vacation from school. Aunt Tia had always spoiled them, just as she had spoiled me as a kid. Same old, she likes to say when she serves you a piece of hot pie in the middle of the afternoon, or gives you an unexpected present. Nana was more understanding than I thought she would be. I think she liked being with her little sister. Tia was younger than Nana, only 78, but she was spry, very contemporary in her outlook, and she was a fabulous cook. That night, she and Nana made penne with gorgonzola cheese, broccoli rabe, and sake tumi cake. I ate as if it were my last meal. Then the kids and I played and talked until the outrageous hour of 11 o'clock, way past their usual bedtimes. They are by no means perfect, but the good times with them certainly outweigh the bad. I tend to talk more about the good, and why not? I'm a father, and I love Damon, Janny, and little Alex more than life itself. Maybe that says something, too. I went back to Washington the following morning. A team of FBI agents had been assigned to my family. It was the kind of attention I'd hoped we would never need. Frankly, it scared the hell out of me. That afternoon, I attended a meeting at the FBI building and learned that more than 400 agents were assigned to finding and capturing Kyle Craig. So far, nothing had gotten out to the press, and Director Burns wanted to keep it that way. So did I. More than that, I wanted to catch Kyle quickly, hopefully before he killed again. But who would he kill? Who might Kyle go after next?
Chapter 103.
Christine, it's Alex, I said. I had butterflies in my stomach. I hate to bother you like this. It's important or I wouldn't call. That was sure the truth. God, I hadn't wanted to make this call.
Is little Alex okay?
She asked.
Is it Nana?
No, everybody's fine. I told a half-truth. There was a brief, uncomfortable silence. Christine and I had been engaged to be married. She was the one who had broken it off because she couldn't handle my life as a homicide detective. Too many bad scenes just like this one.
Alex, this isn't good news, is it? Jeffrey Schaefer? Is he back in the country?
She asked. She sounded afraid, and I felt for her. Jeffrey Schaefer had kidnapped her. No, this isn't about Schaefer. I told her about Kyle Craig. She knew him, liked Kyle, and I could tell she felt violated. She had been hurt badly by the monsters I had met in my work. She couldn't completely forgive me for that, and I didn't blame her much. I couldn't forgive myself sometimes. Talking to Christine made me remember how much I'd loved her. Probably I still did. Is there somewhere safe you can stay for a while? It's important that you go there, I finally said. I hate to do this to you. Kyle is extremely dangerous, Christine.
Oh, Alex. I came out here to be safe. I felt I was safe, but now you're back in my life.
She said she would stay with somebody she trusted. A friend. I asked Christine not to say who or where it was over the phone. When she hung up, she was crying. I felt so bad for her. So terrible about what had happened. The call brought back everything that was wrong between us. I called Jamila next. My excuse was that I wanted to remind her to be careful. Even now.
but I think I just wanted to talk to her. She had been in on so much of this. Unfortunately, she was out when I called. I left a message that I was worried about her and to please be careful. I talked to everyone I could think of who had had some contact with Kyle. I warned a couple detective friends, Rakeem Powell and Jerome Thurman, who were still on the DC force. I doubted Kyle would come after them, but I didn't know for sure. I phoned my chief contact at the Washington Post, a writer named Zachary Scott Taylor. Zach was also one of my best friends in Washington. He wanted to interview me, but I told Zach not to come. Kyle was jealous of the stories Zach had written about me. He had told me as much. For whatever reason, he didn't like Zach. This is serious, I told Zach. Don't underestimate how crazy this man is. You're on his shit list, and that's a bad place to be. I spoke to FBI agents Scores and Riley, who had worked with me on the kidnapping of Maggie Rose Dunn and Michael Goldberg. They knew about the manhunt for Kyle, but hadn't been concerned for their own safety. Now they were. I called my niece Naomi, who had been kidnapped by Casanova. Naomi was practicing law in Jacksonville, Florida. She was living with a good guy named Seth Samuel Taylor. They were planning to marry later this year. He likes to ruin other people's happiness, I told Naomi. Be careful. I know you will be. I called Kate McTiernan in North Carolina. I remembered the meal she'd had with Kyle and me. Had it meant anything more than what it had seemed to on the surface? Who knew with Kyle? Kate promised to be extra careful and reminded me that she was a third-degree black belt now. Kyle had always liked Kate, and I reminded her of that. Actually, the more I talked to Kate, the more worried I was about her. Don't take any chances, Kate. Kyle is the craziest person I've ever met. I contacted Sandy Greenberg, a good friend at Interpol who had worked with Kyle several times. She was shocked to learn that Kyle was a murderer. She promised to be extra careful until he was caught. Sandy also offered to help in any way that she could. Kyle Craig was a cold, heartless murderer. My partner, at times my friend. Or so I thought. I still couldn't believe it. Not completely. I tried to make up a possible hit list for Kyle. 1, myself. 2, Nana and the kids. 3, Samson. 4, Jamila. I realized I was making the list from my point of view, not necessarily Kyle's. I tried another list. 1, Kyle's family, every member. 2, myself and my family. 3, Director Burns of the FBI. 4, Jamila. 5, Kate McTiernan. I sat in my empty house on Fifth Street and wondered what the hell he would do next. It was driving me crazy. I felt like I was running in circles. Kyle was capable of anything.
Chapter 104. He finally called again.
I killed them, and I don't feel a thing. Nothing at all. You will, though, Alex. In a way, you're to blame. Nobody but you. I didn't even want to kill them, but I had to do it. That's the way the horror story has to go. It's out of control now. I'll admit that. The horrifying confession came at 5:15 in the morning. I had been asleep about 3 hours when the phone rang. Panic raced through my body. My heart was pounding so hard I could hear it. Who did you kill? I asked Kyle. Who? Tell me who it was.
Tell me!
What difference does it make? They're dead. Slaughtered. It's someone you care about. There's nothing you can do now except catch me. I suppose I could help you. Isn't that what you want to hear? Would that make this more interesting for you? Would it make it fair? He started to laugh uncontrollably. Christ, I had never known him to lose control. I let him go on, inflated his ego. That's what he wanted and needed, wasn't it? Who had Kyle killed? Oh God, who was dead? It was more than one person. Slaughtered. We always worked as a team. In a way, it would be my crowning moment. To catch myself. I thought about it, actually. Fantasized. What better challenge could there be? I can't think of one. Me against myself.
He started to laugh again. I had to force myself not to ask again who he had murdered. It would just make Kyle angry. He might hang up. Still, my mind was grinding. I was incredibly afraid. Christine? Kate? Jamila? Someone at the FBI? Who? Oh, God, who was it? Have some mercy. Have pity. Show me that you're human, you bastard.
I'm not a highly trained psychologist like yourself. But here's one amateur's theory, anyway,
Kyle said.
I think this whole rage thing might be about sibling rivalry. Could it be? You know, Alex, I had a younger brother. He came along at the height of my Oedipus complex when I was a mere lad of two. He displaced me with my mother and father. Check into it, Alex. Consult with Quantico. Could be important.
He was so calm. And he was ridiculing me. As a detective and as a psychologist. My hands were starting to shake. I'd had enough.
Who did you kill this time? I yelled into the phone. Who is it?
Kyle broke my heart. He told me about the murders he'd just committed in great detail. I was certain that he was telling the truth. Then he hung up, even as I cursed him to hell. Minutes later, I was in my car, bleary-eyed, numb, rushing across Washington to the terrible murder scene.
Chapter 105.
No, no, no! I hadn't expected this. It was like a knife thrust into my heart, then twisted until I screamed. Kyle had hurt me badly, and he wanted me to know something. There was worse to come. This was just the beginning.
I stood silent and transfixed in the bedroom of Zach and Liz Taylor. My eyes were blurred by tears. Two of my dearest friends were dead. I had come to their house dozens of times before, for parties, dinner, late-night talks. Zach and Liz had visited on Fifth Street many times. Zach was the godfather to little Alex. My only consolation was that they had died quickly. Probably Kyle was nervous about getting caught. He knew he had to get in and out of their apartment in the Adams Morgan section of Washington quickly. Whatever his reason, he had killed the Taylors with single gunshots to the head. He hadn't bothered to mutilate the bodies. I thought that the message was clear. This wasn't about them. It was about the two of us. Zach and Liz Taylor hadn't mattered one way or the other to him. Maybe that was the worst thing of all. How easily he could kill. How much he wanted to hurt me. This was just the start of it. It would get worse. There was no evidence of rage, no passion at this crime scene. I almost got the sense that once he was inside their bedroom, he'd had second thoughts. Oh, Kyle, Kyle, have mercy on us. I made mental notes. No need to write any of this down. I knew every horrifying detail by heart. I would never forget any of it until the day I died. The gunshots had blown away the sides of their faces. I had to force myself to look. I remembered how in love they had always seemed to me. Zach had once told me that Liz is the only person I know who I enjoy being with on a long car ride. That was the test for him. They never ran out of things to say to each other. I felt incredibly hollowed out as I stared at them. They were gone now. What a terrible waste. What a horror show. I walked past their bodies to a large casement window that looked out on the street. I was feeling so unreal. I saw the marquee sign for Café Lautrec. Closed now. I thought about Kyle on the run. What he must be thinking. Where he might go next. I wanted to catch him. To stop him. No, I wanted to kill Kyle. I wanted to hurt him in the worst way possible. Someone from the crime scene unit edged up to me, a sergeant named Ed Lyle.
Sorry about your loss. What do you want from us, detective? We're ready to get to work here.
Sketch, video, photograph, I told Lyle. But I really didn't need any of it. I didn't need any more graven images or even any evidence. I knew who the killer was.
Chapter 106.
I got home around 1 that afternoon. I needed to sleep, but I couldn't stay down for more than a couple of hours. I got up and paced all through the empty house on 5th Street. I kept walking from room to room. I felt the need to stop a terrible disaster from happening, but I didn't know where to start. The possible hit lists for Kyle were continually running through my head. My family, Samson, Christine, Jamila Hughes, Kate McTiernan, my niece Naomi, Kyle's own family. I couldn't get the image of Zach and Liz out of my head. They had been executed in the prime of their lives because of me. Finally, I was able to throw up, and it was the best thing that had happened to me that day. I pushed out my guts. Then I slammed the bathroom mirror with the heel of my hand and nearly broke it. Kyle was always a fucking step ahead, right? It had been that way for so many years now. He was such an unbelievable bastard. He had complete confidence in his abilities, including his power to elude us anytime he wanted to. What would be next? Who would he kill? Who? Who? How could he make himself disappear after the killing? How did he blend in and become invisible when so many people were looking for him? He had money. Kyle had taken care of that when he'd played the role of the mastermind. So what was next for him? I worked at my computer late into the night and early morning. The computer was beside my bedroom window. Was he outside watching? I didn't think even Kyle would take that kind of chance now. But hell, how could I rule out anything? He was capable of large-scale mass murder. If that was his plan, where would he strike? Washington? New York City? L.A.? Chicago? His old hometown of Charlotte, North Carolina? Maybe somewhere in Europe. London. Was his family safe? His wife and his son and daughter? I had vacationed with them in Nag's Head one summer. I'd stayed at their home in Virginia a few times over the years. His wife, Louise, was a dear friend. I had promised her I would try to bring Kyle in alive if I possibly could. But now I wondered, did I want to keep that promise? What would I do if I ever caught up with Kyle? He might go after his own parents, especially since Kyle put part of the heavy blame for his behavior on his father. William Hyland Craig had been a general in the Army, then chairman of the board of 2 Fortune 500 companies in and around Charlotte. Nowadays, he gave lectures at 10 to 20,000 a pop. He was on half a dozen boards. He had beaten Kyle as a boy, disciplined him ruthlessly, taught him to hate. Sibling rivalry? Kyle had brought it up himself. He had been highly competitive with his younger brother until Blake's death in 1991. Had Kyle actually killed Blake? It had been ruled a hunting accident. What about the older brother who still lived in North Carolina? Did he think of me as a younger brother? Did Kyle see Blake in me? He was competing with me, and he'd tried to control me from the start. The women in my life might have represented a threat to him, an extreme variant of sibling rivalry. Was that why he had killed Betsy Cavalier? What about Maureen Cook in New Orleans? And Jamila? I made a note to carefully think and plot out one particular angle, a dysfunctional family triangle with both Kyle and me in it. One step ahead. So far, anyway. If he went after his parents or his brother, we would have him. They were being closely protected in Charlotte. The FBI was all over them. Kyle knew that. He wouldn't do something stupid, just cruel and nasty. One step ahead. That seemed to be the key to Kyle's fantasy life, at least as I understood it so far. He wouldn't make the obvious move. He would go at least one move, maybe two, beyond that. But how did he stay a step ahead, especially now? A very bad thought had been running through my head lately. Maybe there was someone else in the FBI helping him. Maybe Kyle had a partner. I had finally drifted off to sleep when the phone in my bedroom woke me. It was 3 in the morning. God damn him. Doesn't he ever sleep? I picked it up, clicked it off, then unplugged the phone from the wall. No more phone tag, Kyle. Fuck you. I was setting the rules now. This was my game, not his.